Shalom. Welcome to SJTF. This is Chaim Ben Pesach. This program is dedicated to elevating the souls of Simcha Chazdai Meir Ben Yecheskel, Pesach Ben Dov, Binyamin Ben Meir, and Yosef Ben Meir. Before we get to our many questions from our great JTFers this week, there are two subjects that I would like to speak about. One is Ted Cruz and why I think we should be supporting his candidacy for president. I think he will run and I think we should support him. And the second subject will be Netanyahu's pending visit to the United States. In the next day or two, he's going to arrive in the United States, and he plans to address the United Nations, and he wants to meet with Barack Hussein Obama at the White House. The purpose of his visit is the Iranian nuclear bomb-making threat. We're going to be discussing the implications of all of that. But first, let's start with Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz is a Republican senator from Texas. And I believe that he's the only true conservative now who is considering running for the presidency in 2016 for the Republican presidential nomination. He is a candidate who on issue after issue has refused to buckle under, has refused to compromise, and has annoyed the establishment politicians in Washington, especially the establishment Republicans, because he doesn't compromise and he tries to push everybody else to take the right stand. He pressures the other politicians in Washington to take the right stand, which is what a leader in Washington is supposed to be doing. If he was pleasing everybody in Washington, if he was pleasing the establishment, the way the establishment candidates do, then I would say he'll be a terrible president. We need somebody who's going to be a bull in the China shop. We need somebody who's not afraid to make the news media and the establishment Republicans and the establishment Democrats and the Washington politicians upset. We need somebody like that. That's the only hope for saving the situation at this point. Someone who has the guts to take tough stands and not compromise and not cave into pressure. And so far, Ted Cruz has been that type of leader. The others have not been, the other possible candidates. They're all terrible. And so, I think we should support Ted Cruz for the Republican presidential nomination. Are the odds against him? Of course they are. He's going to be running for the Republican presidential nomination. The establishment usually decides who the candidate's going to be. They usually convince dumb people who vote in caucuses and primaries, those who are dumb enough to listen to the establishment, to vote for the establishment candidate. That's what happened with John McCain in 2008. That's what happened with George W. Bush in 2000. That's what happened with Mitt Romney in 2012. The establishment picked those candidates and supported those candidates, and they went on to win their party's nomination, and the news media supported those candidates for the Republican nomination. Then the same news media, which was so nice to those establishment candidates when they were running for the nomination, as soon as they got the nomination, the same left-wing news media turned against all of those candidates to try to elect the Democrat. And so, this is the pattern, and this is what's going to happen in 2016. The establishment is going to have their candidate. I don't know if it'll be one candidate or if they'll try more than one, but they're going to have their selection, and they're going to be pushing their candidate. It may be Chris Christie. It may be Rand Paul. Yes, Rand Paul is an establishment Republican. He supports Mitch McConnell against the Tea Party primary challenger in Kentucky. He is willing to play the game that the establishment wants him to play, and he's popular with the news media because he favors legalizing drugs, because he's against taking any action in regard to Iran, because he's a libertarian who doesn't favor a federal constitutional amendment protecting marriage. In other words, he doesn't favor a constitutional amendment preventing gay marriage. So because he takes these relatively left-wing positions, especially in foreign policy, he's actually well-liked by the news media. The news media likes Rand Paul. And the establishment could get along with Rand Paul. He's proven that he has no principles. And so that's a possibility. Maybe Rand Paul, it may be Chris Christie. One of those disastrous candidates will be pushed by the establishment and by the media to get the Republican nomination. So one of the reasons why I think we should be supporting Ted Cruz is to prevent that situation. Because if we have a race in 2016 between Chris Christie and Hillary Clinton, I think Hillary Clinton will be the Democrat nominee. And so if it's a contest between Chris Christie and Hillary Clinton, God forbid, I don't think there's anybody in that race for us to support. I don't think Chris Christie is a lesser of the evils. I think they're both so terrible that I really would say that in a situation like that, there would be a good chance that we would just have to sit out the election and not support either one of them. And the same thing with Rand Paul versus Hillary Clinton. They're both so terrible and so disastrous that I really feel that it would not be worth our while even to get involved at this point. And so to prevent that scenario, to try to help elect a candidate or nominate a candidate that we at least could support against Hillary Clinton, I think we should be backing Ted Cruz because he is that type of candidate that we could in good conscience support. And I could support Ted Cruz enthusiastically so far, at least with the positions he's taken so far. I could enthusiastically support his candidacy so far. So we really want him to win and we want to help him win. That's the first reason why we would want to support him. The second reason is to influence him. He has said that he believes that we must support Israel with unshakable support. That's the word he uses all the time when describing Israel. We have to have unshakable support for Israel. And when he spoke to Reverend Hagee's Christians United for Israel meeting, when he spoke to that convention, it was actually a convention that they held, he praised them for understanding the biblical commandment. I don't remember the exact word, but he basically said there's a biblical commandment to support Israel, and he basically was saying he agreed that there's a biblical obligation and a biblical commandment to support Israel. That is very important, because he is an evangelical Southern Baptist. And if he believes that God commands us to support Israel, which he clearly does, and if he believes that we have to be guided by that, that is the type of person we want in the White House, because that's the type of person who's not going to let Arab oil blackmail and the news media and other and establishment people who have connections with the Arab petrodollars and who are being bought off by Saudi Arabia. He's not going to let those people dictate to him what the policy should be in the Middle East. If he really believes, I have to do this because God commands us and God will bless America if America blesses Israel, and God will curse America if America curses Israel. If America is against Israel, God will curse America and destroy America. If God is for Israel, that's the only hope for America. If he really believes that, that is the type of person we want in the White House. Mike Huckabee believes that, and Mike Huckabee would have been a great president in terms of Israel for that reason. And I believe America would have been blessed by God because Mike Huckabee would have been pro-Israel. You know, if America is pro-Israel, America is blessed. And so that's why I wanted Mike Huckabee to get elected to the presidency, but he decided not to run. And I don't think he's really that serious a possibility for 2016. I don't know if he's going to run in 2016. He has, you know, he has his program that he enjoys doing on Fox. So if he runs, if he doesn't run, I don't know at this point. We wanted him to run in 2012. Then he had a real opportunity to win, in my opinion. He didn't go for it. I was disappointed because I really think he could have been a president that could have brought blessings to America and to Israel. But Ted Cruz is clearly running. There's no question in my mind that right now he's running. Of course, anything can happen in the next 2 or 3 years, and to stop him from running, anything can happen. But right now, he's running. Okay, a guy who isn't even in the Senate for a whole year yet. I mean, he was just elected to the Senate less than a year ago. He's already made several trips to Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and all the early primary and caucus states. There's no question he's making the rounds and making the moves that a presidential candidate makes. He's preparing for a run. And so I think there are reasons to support him. Even though, to get back to the question of his positions on the issues, he has taken a stand that we have to support Israel and have to have unshakable support for Israel, but he hasn't defined that fully. On Iran, he's taken a good position. I heard his speech. He gave a speech in which he spoke about Iran, and he took a good position. He said the United States should issue an ultimatum, and if they don't immediately open up all their sites to inspectors so that we could see that they're dismantling any nuclear activity and that they're not enriching uranium and that they're not involved in any nuclear activity anymore. If they don't open up those sites immediately and continue to have verifiable inspections there all the time to make sure that they're not engaged in a nuclear program, if they're not willing to do that, we should issue an ultimatum and say, you don't do that, we're going to bomb and destroy your your nuclear bomb-making facilities. That's what he has proposed doing. So that is a good position on Iran. That's the type of position that would that could prevent Iran from obtaining nuclear bombs. But he hasn't come out with a position on whether or not there should be a so-called Palestinian state. Because we have people who claim to be pro-Israel, like Sarah Palin, but support a so-called Palestinian state. And I think Sarah Palin genuinely does believe that she's supporting Israel. She's also an evangelical Christian. But she's just too dumb to know. And she is. And when it comes to the Middle East, she is dumb. I mean, she supports the two. She said, I support the two-state solution. Yes, she is dumb. I don't think she even realizes that what she's supporting is suicide for Israel. I think she thinks she has to do what the Israeli government says. That's what being pro-Israel means. Mike Huckabee was against the so-called Palestinian state, was against Israel giving up land. So Mike Huckabee was willing to go against what the Israeli government supported even. He was willing to go to the right of the Israeli government, which is very unusual. In other words, he was being more Catholic than the Pope, so to speak, more Jewish than the Jews, more Zionistic than the Jews. That's what we need, really, in the White House. I hope that we can convince Ted Cruz to do that as well. And I'm hoping that if we support him, that we can influence him and get him to take that type of stand, the type of stand that Mike Huckabee took. I'm hoping we can. If we're his early supporters, if we're his first serious Zionist supporters, if we're the first serious Jews and righteous Gentiles that are supporting him with videos and wherever we can support him in whatever way we can, we may get his attention, we may get the attention of his supporters, and we may influence them. And they may agree that there shouldn't be a Palestinian state because Ted Cruz has gone against the grain on other issues. He's bucked the establishment consensus position on other issues. He did that with the filibuster and with Obamacare. And he's been doing that. He's gone against amnesty, which is the establishment consensus position. Rand Paul supports amnesty. Chris Christie supports amnesty. Marco Rubio supports amnesty. All the other candidates are basically amnesty supporters. They want to give amnesty to 20 million illegal aliens and open this country up to a third world invasion. The one candidate who has consistently been against amnesty in any form has been Ted Cruz. So I'm hoping that we can get him to also go against the establishment position and the establishment Washington consensus on the issue of the Middle East. To be against the Palestinian state, to be against Israel giving up any land, to be for Jewish settlements in Judea and Samaria and Jerusalem and the Golan Heights. If we can get him to do that, then he would really be a great candidate, and if he ever got elected, he'd be a great president. So we want to influence him, and influence his supporters. And we want to try to help him win because we don't want Chris Christie or Rand Paul to get the Republican nomination. So if we want to prevent that, we got to start working now to stop that because that's going to be a disaster. And finally, so we have two reasons to want to support him. One, because we really want to help him win to prevent the bad candidates like Christie and Paul from getting the nomination. Second, because we want to influence him on the issues and get him to oppose a Palestinian state and so on. And a third reason why I think we should support him is because we may get new JTF members and supporters. It may help us grow our movement. We may gain a lot of new supporters, I'm hoping. Unfortunately, that didn't happen with our anti-Obama campaign last year. It didn't bring in a lot of new supporters to us, and that was a disappointment. But maybe this time it will. Maybe this time it'll work. I don't know. I think we should try. So those are the reasons why I think we should back him. Now, is there a downside to supporting someone this early? Of course there is. Of course there's a downside. Of course there's the possibility that there's a very real possibility that we're supporting a loser. The odds are against him. His chances of winning are slim. because the establishment's against him, the media's against him, the big money people are against him. Hillary Clinton is leading all the possible Republican candidates by double-digit margins in all of the national polls, so it looks like Hillary Clinton will be the next president. God forbid, but it looks that way. And even in the fight for the Republican nomination, Ted Cruz has an uphill battle. He has to beat the establishment in the primaries and caucuses and get a majority of the delegates by going to the average rank-and-file Republicans. He has to basically take over the Republican Party with a hostile takeover the way Ronald Reagan did in 1980, the way Barry Goldwater did in 1964. He's got to repeat that. It is possible, it's doable, but it's unusual that that happens. Most of the time, Republican voters do not go against the establishment. Is it possible that he will be able to get a grassroots uprising that will succeed in winning him a majority of delegates, going over the heads of the establishment and defeating the leaders and the establishment people and the media? Is it possible? It is possible. Goldwater did it in 64. Reagan did it in 1980. But aside from those 2 years, it's very hard to find other examples of where that happened. So it's unusual. So the odds are against him. The odds are against him. And so we're supporting somebody whom the odds are against. That's one of the downsides. Another downside, of course, is the possibility that he'll disappoint us. There's always a possibility that he'll disappoint us or betray us. God forbid, I hope not. I would really be disappointed because right now I really like this guy. But is there a possibility he'll betray us? Is there a possibility he'll come out and take positions on the issues that are bad? Of course there's that possibility. That danger always exists. So we're taking a chance. We're taking a chance. We're betting that we can possibly influence him, that he seems to be a principled guy, and that we're also basically saying that win or lose, even if we do lose, even if the odds are against us, this is a fight worth, it's a fight worth fighting. It's a battle worth fighting. Because I really think the situation is so bad now in America and in Israel, so terrible, with such terrible leaders, that I really don't think we have that much to lose. And I really believe that in America, at least, he is the one true hope. I think we are the one true hope for Israel. And I think for America, he is the one true hope right now that I see on the horizon. It doesn't mean there won't be other things that may come up in the future. There may be. But right now, I see him as the one true hope for America, to save America and for America's future, and to also get an American president who will be pro-Israel. He is the one true hope for us, even though that's a slim hope, even though the odds are against him. That's the way I see it right now. So I recommend that we support him. We have a thread, a sticky thread that I put up on the forum with a poll. And so far, it seems to be unanimous. Let me just check and see the results of the poll right now as I'm doing this program. One moment. Let me just see what the results are so far. So far, the results are, should JTF support Ted Cruz for president in 2016? 15 have said yes, 0 have said no. So far, it's 15-0. 15 of our members have voted in favor. Nobody has voted against. So, you know, so far, it looks like JTF members agree with me on this issue. There seems to be, our fellow JTFers also seem to be enthusiastic about Ted Cruz. I sense that among the grassroots conservatives, there is an enthusiasm for this guy. I sense that. I really think there is. Will that be enough to get him elected all the way to the White House? I don't know. But I do think it's worth trying. If you want to vote on our poll, you're welcome to do so if you're a JTF member. And it's a sticky thread. And you can vote in the poll, but I think this is the direction that we're going to try to go in, and let's hope that we can do some good here, and maybe it also will help our movement. In addition to that, maybe we'll bring new people into our movement, God willing. I also want to speak briefly about Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, the so-called Prime Minister of Israel, coming to the United States in the next day or two. He's going to address the United Nations, and he's going to meet with Barack Hussein Obama. He wants to convince the world not to believe Iran's pretending now to be for negotiations and pretending that they're not seeking a nuclear weapon when obviously they are. He wants to alert the world to the fact that Iran is lying, and obviously Iran is lying, and obviously this is a con job. The problem is, now it's already, we're already in a situation where it's going to be very, very hard now. Now it's really going to be almost impossible to convince people of that. Very, very hard to convince people of that. Because he waited too long. We warned him and we told you so. Once again, we were right. We were right from the start. For 20 years, we've been saying, destroy Iran's nuclear bomb-making program. Don't convince people. Don't make speeches. Don't go to Obama and don't go to Bush and don't go to this one and that one. Just do it. Just send the Israeli Air Force to do it. Israel has the military capability to set back that program at least several years. Go and destroy the program. And afterwards, you can do the explanations, and afterwards, you'll deal with the, you know, you'll deal with the after effects. But at least, you'll have an established fact that the program has been destroyed and set back, and the danger has been removed for a while. That's what we have been urging for 20 years now. There were so many opportunities. Dozens and dozens of times, there were golden opportunities for Israel to go in and do this, and there would have been minimal condemnation and minimal opposition to Israel doing this. In last year's presidential election, for instance, if Netanyahu had ordered the attack during the presidential election, Mitt Romney made it clear that he would have supported Israel doing this, and the Republicans would have supported Israel. Obama, running for re-election, also would have been careful in what he says. He would not have started condemning Israel in the middle of a presidential campaign or taking action against Israel in the middle of a presidential campaign. That was the perfect time, the perfect opportunity to go in and take care of this problem. But Netanyahu is such a coward, such a wimp, such a pathetic loser, such a ghetto-minded zero, that there's not one opportunity he hasn't missed. Now that Iran is playing this new game and is so close to getting the bomb, and now that the world is embracing Iran, now he's speaking out and he's warning and he's filled with the warnings. I mean, now people will condemn Israel and people will say, why did you do this? We had a chance to change Iran and they were becoming moderate and all the other lies. Now Israel will get a lot of condemnation if Israel destroys the Iranian nuclear bomb-making program. That would not have been true if they had done it when we urged all the... I mean, how many... You JTFers, you are witnesses. You veteran JTFers, you're witnesses to the hundreds, literally hundreds of programs that we did, videos that we did, urging in the most urgent language, urging Israel to take this action as quickly as possible. Once again, we were right. And once again, the Jewish people and the world are in trouble because of the traitor leaders that we have. Netanyahu is a traitor. And so he's now coming and he's going to try to plead this case. He's going to try to say things that the world doesn't want to hear. And that the American, I don't know if the American people want to hear it, but Obama certainly doesn't want to hear it. And the media certainly doesn't want to hear what he has to say. I still say that despite the fact that now Israel will be attacked and will be condemned for doing this, Israel should still go in, of course Israel should still go in and destroy the nuclear bomb-making program. Who cares about the condemnations? I mean, what is more dangerous, the prospect of a nuclear holocaust? The prospect of a nuclear-armed Iran and then a nuclear arms race in which Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Jordan, Syria, Egypt, and all these other countries acquire nuclear bombs in order to protect themselves from Iran, and we have a huge nuclear arms race, and all the Muslim countries surrounding Israel go nuclear? I mean, isn't that the worst possible nightmare? Isn't that much worse than having Obama and the UN and the media condemn you for a few days, or even for a few weeks? I mean, how crazy can you be? Israel should still go in and destroy Iran's nuclear bomb-making program. To hell with world opinion. To hell with the media, to hell with Obama. Israel should still do it. But it would have been a lot easier to do it if they had done it when we were urging that they do it. And by the way, Netanyahu was prime minister in the late 1990s, when it really, really would have been easy to do it. Then it would have been really easy to do it. It would have been a three-hour bombing operation at that time, because it wasn't a very extensive program yet in late 1990s. Then it really would have been a breeze. And we were urging Netanyahu to do it then. We had our program on QPTV, and we were urging it at that time. But, of course, who listens to us? Who cares what we have to say? Certainly among the leaders, they don't listen to us and they don't pay attention to our warnings, even though we've been proven right again and again. And they, the experts, the generals, the professors, the columnists, the media people, the journalists, the politicians, they've been proven wrong over and over again. We've been proven right over and over again. And so that's the situation. We're going to continue to push and urge Israel to strike and destroy Iran's nuclear bomb-making program. We're going to do our best to wake people up as much as we can. And we're going to simultaneously make our push against the Palestinian state. There is no Palestine. There are no Palestinians, of course, and a so-called Palestinian state would be national suicide. We're going to continue that as well. That's going to be our Israel campaign. We're going to do that in Hebrew, and we're going to have a campaign like that in English as well. And simultaneously, we're going to begin this campaign, God willing, to promote Senator Ted Cruz for the Republican presidential nomination and to try to influence him. If Ted Cruz disappoints us, if he comes out with positions on the Middle East that disappoint us, we may back out. You know, there's no, you know, this is not set in concrete. We will back out if he does that. I hope he doesn't, I'm slightly optimistic that we can get him to take pro-Israel stands on the issues. But if he disappoints us, of course, then we'll just back out. We won't support him anymore. I think it's worth the risk. I think it's worth the risk, and I think he's, again, proven himself to be the type of tough leader that we need at this time. That's where we stand. And if you agree that there's a desperate need to wake people up, that there's a need to help Ted Cruz in his campaign for the presidency, that there's a need to get Israel to destroy Iran's nuclear bomb-making program, that there's a need to tell the truth about Israel and the desperate situation that Israel is in because of her terrible leaders, that there's a need to do this and that we're really the only voice doing this at this time. If you agree that we can't be silent, we have to speak up, we have to try to wake people up, which is what we're doing with our videos. You see it with our videos. You see every week that we're putting up Hebrew and English videos, and we're speaking up. If you agree that this is important and that we're not allowed to be silent, then help us. Help us with the English and Hebrew videos, first of all. Help us on Facebook and YouTube in promoting the videos. That means doing five things on Facebook and YouTube. Like, favorite, comment, share, and mirror our videos. The Hebrew videos and the English videos. Even if you don't speak Hebrew, you can help us promote the videos in the search engines. The second thing you can do is help us with our forums and Facebook pages. We need good posts. We need good threads on our forums and on our Facebook pages. When there are good threads and good posts, the forums and the movement become more attractive, and the Facebook pages, the movement becomes more attractive, and hopefully will bring more people into our movement. So that's the second thing you can do. And third, most importantly, of course, our downfall that has really prevented us from doing so many things we could have done to make this a better world has been the lack of funds. It was the downfall of our great leader, Rabbi Meir Kahana. Zatzal was a downfall of right-wing Jews for 150 years now. Even before the Holocaust, the Jabotinsky supporters didn't have enough money to push their message, which could have prevented the Holocaust. So this has been our downfall. We're going to use whatever money we have and the budget that we have. You know that we're going to do everything we can and try as hard as we can to influence things, and we're obligated to do so. But the more we have, the more we can do. It helps. Every contribution helps. Every check, money order, cash contribution sent through the regular mail to a post office box, it makes a difference. It helps. It's important. It's important that we wake people up and that we take a stand. We're not allowed to be silent. And you never know how much we're going to influence people. I think we're having some influence, certainly among the thousands of people who come to our videos. And I think that's important. I think it's important that people be brought the truth. So we need financial support, and God bless the great JTFers who do make checks, money orders, and cash donations and out to JTF and send it to our post office box on a regular basis. God bless the great JTFers who are doing that. And equally important, or the same, basically it's the same thing, if people prefer to do it online, they can simply click on the donate button on our English language main page, jtf.org, or on our Hebrew language main page, hayamin.org. There's a donate button on top. And then very conveniently with your credit card, you can help us. It makes a difference. God bless the great JTFers who are helping us. We need your help. It's very important. And so that's where we stand right now. We're about to begin. We're about to embark on some new important initiatives, and hopefully we'll be able to bring results that will make this a better world. Hopefully we'll have good news that will come from this. You'll see our videos coming up, and you'll see the things that we're doing and the initiatives that we pursue, and hopefully it'll make a difference. At least with us, you know, we're going to try as hard as we can and do everything we can to make a difference. Now we're going to go to our great questions from our great JTFers. Okay, one moment, and let me just make sure, yep, this is good. And now we go to the great Joe Gutfeld, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, what is your favorite Jewish holiday and why? Thanks, unquote. I love all of the Jewish holidays, but my favorite Jewish holiday is probably Pesach, Passover. I love the magnificent story of the defenseless, unarmed, helpless slaves humbling and defeating the greatest empire on the face of the earth in those days, the Egyptian Empire. Really God doing it for them, but the fact that they won that victory because of God and just the whole story of how Moshe Rabbeinu, of how Moses leads the Jews to freedom through such miracles. And the great Kiddush Hashem, the sanctification of God's name on that holiday, and all the wonderful things that happen. I just think it's such a magnificent, uplifting story. I also love Purim. I mean, Purim is such a happy holiday. I love a lot of the Jewish holidays. I love all the Jewish holidays, but my favorite would probably be Pesach. Thank you, Joe. And now we go to our great friend Camel Jockeys Murder 59 People in Nairobi, Kenya, who writes, and I quote, one, what are your thoughts on actor James Woods, unquote? James Woods, relatively speaking, is not that bad. He signed an ad supporting Israel during the Second Lebanon War in 2006. He supports Republican candidates, usually. So for Hollywood, he's pretty good, considering that he's in Hollywood. I mean, he supports Republican candidates for president, and he has been a supporter of Israel. I think, relatively speaking, he's not bad for Hollywood. And second question, thoughts on Roger Ebert. Where is he now? Unquote. Well, Roger Ebert was an atheist, and he publicly said he was an atheist and a leftist. He promoted Hollywood degeneracy, promoted all the nasty and vulgar movies, and gave good reviews to all the disgusting, degenerate, deviant garbage that comes out of Hollywood. So he was an evil person. He brought evil into the world, and he promoted evil and sanctioned evil. So I think he was a bad person. Where is he now? I don't know where he is now, but I know it's not in a good place, because the things he did in this world were things that made this world worse, even worse. And now the third question, discuss events that took place in Kenya, unquote. Well, you know, we actually did a video on that, on the mass murder that took place in Kenya, the Islamic terrorists from Al-Shahab, which is an Islamic terrorist organization, and what they did in Kenya. The amazing thing is the vast majority of the 59 people who were murdered in Kenya in a shopping mall were black. These are black Africans being murdered. And yet you never see Barack Hussein Obama, Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, Louis Farrakhan condemn Islamic terrorism, even though the Muslims slaughter huge numbers of black Africans. 3 million black Sudanese have been slaughtered by Arab Sudanese from the north. Northern Sudan is Arab. Southern Sudan is black. And the Arabs in the north have been committing genocide, have been trying to wipe out the black population in southern Sudan. Many of the people who have been slaughtered in southern Sudan, by the way, are Muslims, are black Muslims. So even though they're Muslim, they're being murdered just because of the color of their skin, just because they're black Africans. Millions, literally millions of black Africans have been massacred in holocausts and by Muslims, all by Muslims. And yet Barack Hussein Obama, who is supported by 97% of black American voters in the elections, Barack Hussein Obama praises Islam all the time, refers to the evil Quran as the Holy Quran, quotes from this evil book all the time, and is a Muslim, praises Islam, and he's a Muslim, and he quotes from that evil, murderous book all the time. Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, of course, always praising Islam, supporting Islam. And Louis Farrakhan has black people going to million man marches and becoming Muslims, preaching Islam. So this is. Sick beyond all words. I mean, this is beyond anything Orwell could ever have come up with in his book, 1984, where he said you'd have sick people saying good is bad, and basically the biblical... Orwell is like the secular version of the biblical admonition of woe unto those who say good is evil, and evil is good, and light is darkness, and darkness is light. In Orwell's book in 1984, peace was war, and war was peace, and love was hate, and hate was love. Everything was opposite, upside down, like we see in the world today. And among black people, that is what we have today. With black leaders and among black people, you have that mentality. They support people who murder them. They support people who started the slave trade. And to this day, there are millions of black slaves in the Muslim world. To this day, they have black slavery. And yet black people continue to support them, continue to support the Muslims and want to be Muslims and have a black Muslim in the White House that 97% of the blacks voted for. So this is beyond sick. It's beyond crazy. It's beyond sick. It's just madness that is indescribable. That's my view on Kenya. That's one of the things I think we should be learning from Kenya. Thank you, Camel Jockeys. And now we go to the great Dr. Dan, the voice of reason, common sense, and logic, who writes, and I quote, one, talk about Lavan, Rachel and Leah's uncle. You mean Rachel and Leah's father. He was actually the father of Rachel and Leah. Lavan comes from, you know, you have the title that was given to him in the Bible, Lavan Ha'arami. And the word Arami, I'm a little reluctant to get into this sometimes because it involves Hebrew and Hebrew letters, and many of our listeners don't understand what I'm talking about, but I'll try a little bit. Lavan Ha'arami comes from the word Harami, is a play on the word, a symbolic play on the word Ramai. That's what Chazal, the rabbinic sages, teach us. He was called Ha'arami because he was Haramai. Haramai means the deceiver. He was a deceiver. What do we mean by this? Lavan was especially dangerous because he pretended to be righteous. He pretended to be a tzaddik. And in reality, he was a rasha. He was wicked. He was evil. That's the worst type of enemy. Chazal teach us a very important lesson. Absolute lies with no truth whatsoever, are not dangerous. Because if there is not some truth in them, the lie cannot stand. If someone tells you something that is an absolute lie, that's so obviously a lie, it's not a threat because it cannot stand. The danger is when you have an element of truth in the lie. If there's an element of truth, the only lies that are really threatening and that are really dangerous are lies where there's an element of truth, where there's some element of truth there so that people can believe the lie. It's the element of truth that deceives people. Lavan was a Ramai, he was a deceiver. Because he pretended to be righteous, and he did what he did supposedly in the name of some righteous desire, when in reality his desires were evil. So he was the most dangerous type of enemy. That's why the new president of Nazi Iran, Rouhani, is much more dangerous than the old president, Ahmadinejad. Because Ahmadinejad told us honestly that he wanted to destroy Israel, wipe Israel off the map. He called for the destruction of America openly. He had a conference where he said, it's going to be the end of America, and we dream of the day when the United States of America is going to be destroyed. He spoke honestly, Ahmadinejad. Rouhani also has made very vicious anti-Semitic and anti-American and anti-Israel statements in Farsi. But when he speaks in English, or when he speaks, when he speaks in Farsi and has his remarks translated into English for an English audience, for a Western audience, he's very careful. He's deceptive. He's like Lavan. And so he's much more dangerous than Ahmadinejad. You know, one of the things frequently said in the Israeli media is that Israel now feels nostalgia for the days of Ahmadinejad. They wish Ahmadinejad was still president, and it's true. And they're right. Because it's always better to have a dumb enemy than a clever enemy. Clever Muslims are much more dangerous than honest Muslims. Honest Muslims like Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah, as murderous as they are, they're much less dangerous than clever Muslims. Clever Muslims like the Saudis, who are acquiring trillions of petrodollars and buying up whole countries. Clever Muslims like the Egyptians, like Anwar el-Sadat, yimach shmo, who got Israel to surrender the entire Sinai. Clever Muslims like the ones who are trying to get Israel in negotiations now to give up Judea and Samaria and Jerusalem and go back to the pre-1967 Auschwitz lines. The clever Muslims, the clever enemy is the more dangerous enemy. You always want an enemy who tells you honestly what they plan to do. That's an enemy you can deal with. When it's black and white and you know what you're confronting and you know what you have to deal with, that is way, way better than someone who is a deceiver like Lavan. And now Dr. Dan writes, and I quote, talk about Reuven sleeping with Bilha. Okay, Bilha was the concubine of Reuven's father Yaakov. Reuven is one of the 12, he's one of the 12 sons of Yaakov. Yaakov is Jacob, our father Jacob. Jacob had 12 sons, and the 12 sons that he had became the 12 Shvatim, the 12 tribes of Israel. And his Bechor, his firstborn son out of the 12 was Reuven. And so you have the tribe of Reuven. But Reuven, when Reuven was in the world, before he became a tribe, you know, all of these were 12, before they became tribes, they were actually 12, just 12 sons. Reuven slept with his father's concubine, Bilha. And this was a very serious sin. And his father eventually, when he gives his final blessings to all of the sons before his death, his father, Yaakov, in the Torah, rebukes Reuven for this. He rebukes him for having committed this sin. So there's no question it was a serious sin that he slept with his father's concubine, Bilha. It was something that he did, which was terrible. And now Dr. Dan writes, and I quote, three, Jacob's reaction to Levi and Shimon's massacre, unquote. Okay, Jacob, Yaakov, Well, first let's give some background here. Shechem raped the sister of the 12 sons. You have the sons of Yaakov, right? Actually, at that time it was 11 sons. Binyamin hadn't been born yet, so it was actually 11 sons. You have the 11 sons of Yaakov, and they had one girl, Dinah. Then one sister. And Dinah was raped by Shechem. And the people of the city where Shechem came from, Shechem was the prince in the city. His father was the king, and he was the prince. And the people in the city supported Shechem. He took Dinah hostage after he raped her, and he wanted to marry her. So he went to Yaakov, and he went to the brothers, and he said, "I want to marry. I'm in love with her, and I want to marry." After he raped her, after he brutally raped her, and the Torah is very clear that it was a brutal rape. And he wanted to marry her. He was in love with her even after he raped her. And so the sons, two of the sons of Yaakov, Shimon and Levi, said, "You want to take Dinah to be your wife? No problem. Fine." And then they also proposed to Yaakov and his sons, Your women will be our wives, and our women will be your wives. We'll be one people. We'll become one people. This is what they proposed to them after raping their sister. And Shimon and Levi decided to deceive this rapist and said to him, "Oh, yeah, sure, we'll be happy. We'll be happy to become one people with you, but only on one condition. You have to be circumcised. We can't marry people and become one people unless you're circumcised. That's very important to us. You and everybody in the city has to be circumcised. If you're circumcised, then we'll all become one people and you'll get all the blessings and of Israel. We'll all become one people." So they agreed. Shechem and his father and people in the city agreed. They all circumcised themselves. And you know, circumcision for adults without anesthesia in those days was very painful. And on the third day, the pain is most severe on the third day. So, you know, and then after the third day, the healing process begins and people do heal pretty quickly after that. After that, it's pretty quick. But for the first 3 days, there is pain, and the third day is the peak of the pain. So on the third day, when they were in really bad pain after having circumcised themselves, after they went through the circumcision process, all the people in the town, they were weak and they were in pain. That's when the brothers, Shimon and Levi, who urged them to become circumcised in the first place, they were weak, they took out their swords and they slaughtered all of them. Because they were in bed, you know, still recovering from the circumcision. So these two brothers, that was when they came in and slaughtered everyone in the town. Yaakov rebukes them for this, for doing this, but he rebukes them for their tactics. He doesn't rebuke them on the moral issue. He says we are few in number and they'll destroy us, but immorally he doesn't complain. He does not say what you did was wrong, you shouldn't have killed all these people. What are you talking about? Just because they raped your sister and just because they supported the rapist and they let him be their leader, you don't kill everybody, you know, this is... No. He never said that. He never rebuked them morally. In other words, morally they were okay what they did. But he said tactically, he said, we're so few in number. Look how few we are. All the people in Canaan, in Canaan, are gonna turn on us now. Look what you've done to us. Now you're going to turn everybody against us. So he only rebuked them tactically, which shows what the Torah thinks. When our enemies dare to defile a daughter of Israel, how severely the Torah views that, that it's okay to go in and massacre everyone in the whole town. Now, even tactically though, eventually, Shimon and Levi were proven correct. They were proven right because nothing happened to them after that. In fact, the opposite occurred. This created a deterrence. The people in the land of Israel were terrified of them after that, after they massacred everybody in that town. So it actually strengthened their position. So Yaakov, who felt tactically that this is a bad move tactically, not morally, but tactically, even on tactics, in the end he was proven wrong. They were not attacked by the people in the land of Israel because of this. It did not lead to the consequences that he predicted it could lead to. So that's the story of Levi and Shimon, a real story in how you react when anyone dares to defile a daughter of Israel. And how I wish the Jews would react that way when the Arab Muslim Nazis rape Jewish women in Israel, which is something that occurs in Israel, and you know, and nothing is done against these beasts. Yimach shmam v'zichram. Thank you, Dr. Dan. And now we go to the great Tag Mechir Tzedek, who writes, and I quote, "Should people in Israel avoid using Israeli currency with the pictures of Reshaim?" Unquote. Reshaim means evil people. No, I don't think we have a chance. I'm very much against the fact that there are pictures of Reshaim on Israeli currency, but I don't think we have a choice. We have to use the currency, unfortunately. If we take power, of course, we're going to change that. We're only going to have pictures of righteous people on the currency. But right now, I don't think we have a choice. Tag Mechir now writes, and I quote, "Another shiur on Perush HaMakabi, please," unquote. Okay, Perush HaMakabi is the book from Arab Mir Kahana, Zecher Tzaddik VeKadosh Livracha, Hashem Yikom Damo, our great leader. One of the things Rabbi Kahana teaches us in this great book is that if we don't remove the Arab Nazis from Eretz Yisrael, this is a Chilul Hashem. And he points out, and again, it's a little difficult for me to explain this because it involves Hebrew letters and Hebrew words, so I'm not going to go into the Hebrew here. An extra yud in one of the words, and I'm not going to go into some of the things that the rabbi points out because I don't think most JTFers will understand what I'm saying. So I'll just say in general terms that the rabbi points out brilliantly, brilliantly, how this is a chilul Hashem, a desecration of God's name. Because the Arabs living in the land of Israel openly defy his plan to bring the Jews back, and they murder his people. I mean, they go to war to wipe the Jews out. You can't have a chilul Hashem, a desecration of God's name, worse than that. Not only do they have the arrogance, the audacity to oppose God's plan to return his people to their homeland, but they want to exterminate God's people. They want to exterminate God's children. I mean, this is the ultimate example of arrogant, defiant attack, an arrogant, defiant attack on God's name. And so allowing millions of people with this Nazi attitude to remain in the Holy Land when God restores Jewish sovereignty is the ultimate Chilul Hashem. And the rabbi writes in Perush HaMakabi how God mourns and joins in the mourn, that it's not only the problem, it's not only a problem for Israel and the Jewish people, it's a problem for God, supposedly. I say supposedly because God, of course, you know, how do you really influence God? God is absolutely perfect. But in a sense that we don't understand, God also mourns and God is also deeply troubled by this, that we have allowed this terrible desecration of his name to take place when our purpose in this world is to sanctify his name, to remove the Arab Nazi enemy, to remove the cancer from the land of Israel, and to sanctify God's name and create a holy nation and a light unto the nations, a nation of priests that will bring final redemption. That's what our job is, and we can't do that when we continue to allow this Chilul Hashem to exist. That the rabbi clearly proves, and he does it by citing scripture and by citing Chazal. He does it brilliantly in Perush HaMakabi. Thank you, Tag Mechir Tzedek. And now we go to our great friend, Wandering Samurai 81, who writes, and I quote, "Dear Chaim, your thoughts on Russia banning the Quran. Should Israel learn from this?" Unquote. Well, a local judge in Russia did indeed say that you can't translate the Quran because it's extremist. So, I mean, he actually issued a court order saying that you're not allowed to translate the Quran because it's extremist. You know, again, this is something that you wouldn't see in any other country. Do I think Israel should learn from this? Absolutely. I think Israel and America should learn from this. You know, Americans and Israelis are very sensitive about freedom of religion because we've been taught that you have to have freedom of religion and religious liberty. And generally speaking, you know, you should try to have freedom of religion. You know, the United States was built as a nation with religious liberty and freedom. But when you have a situation like Islam, Islam is an exception. Islam is not just a religion. It's a religion that teaches people to commit mass murder and genocide. That should not be acceptable. That should not be part of freedom of religion. People should not be free to organize to commit genocide and to destroy the United States of America. And they shouldn't be free to organize to destroy Israel either. So we should learn from that. We should learn that freedom of religion should have some limits. People should have a degree of freedom to worship as they wish. But once you have a situation where you have a religion like Islam, which is, again, the exception, when you have a religion like Islam, which teaches people that they must exterminate anyone who does not think like them, that they must plot and do everything they can and teach their children to be filled with hate and to exterminate and commit murder and terrorism, when you have a religion like this, that is a ticking time bomb. That's a cancer. And banning that type of thing, banning individuals and beliefs that are aimed at perpetrating genocide, in my opinion, is justified. Thank you, Wandering Samurai. And now we go to the great Nekama, who writes, and I quote, "My sons and I observed an Arab defecating on an Arab gravestone in the cemetery outside the Lion's Gate in Yerushalayim. Unbelievable. Please comment," unquote. Yeah, I mean, I saw things when I was at Etz Yisrael. I saw things that Arabs did that were just unbelievably disgusting. I mean, unbelievably disgusting. I'm not even going to... I don't want to nauseate our... Believe me, some of them would literally nauseate people if I told you some of the things I saw. Just so disgusting. I'll give you one illustration, one quick illustration. The things, when I speak about nauseating people, I have stories that are much worse than this, which I'm not going to tell you. Because I don't want people to... It's just too grotesque. But I'm going to give you one story that's pretty disgusting, but not even the worst. We went to park our car, me and this nice couple that I was visiting with in Israel. We went to park the car in the parking lot. And of course, the guy in the parking lot is an Arab. They hire an Arab to have their parking lot. But it was free. You know, it was free parking. But still, the guy in charge there, they have an Arab in charge there. And the Arab is speaking to an Israeli. And while he's speaking to the Israeli, they're speaking in the entrance of the parking lot. While he's speaking to him, he's picking his nose. I couldn't believe it. He's actually picking his nose openly and just, you know, cleaning out his nose with his finger while he's speaking to this guy. I mean, this is not civilized behavior. I mean, to pick your nose while you're speaking to somebody, I think it's disgusting to pick your nose at any time. You know, if you want to clean your nose, you should blow your nose or do whatever you have to do to clean your nose. You can clean your nose by blowing your nose. Human beings have to do that. We're all human beings. We all have certain functions that are not very pleasant that we sometimes have to do. But to pick your nose is disgusting even in private. It's not sanitary and it's not something people should do. But publicly, in front of somebody, while you're having a conversation with somebody, you start picking away at your nose like you're digging for gold. I mean, this is just not civilized behavior. And this is the type of behavior that I saw. And I also saw an Arab, they love to pick their nose, by the way. I saw a Bedouin Arab on a bus picking his nose and taking his finger after he picked his nose and wiping it on the chairs. He was cleaning his finger off by wiping what he picked from his nose on the chairs, on the chair on the bus. You know, and I told, and I said to him, what the hell are you doing? I said to him. He said, mind your own business. I said, you do that again. Anyway, we got into a little bit of a conversation. And finally, the bus driver calls a cop over, and the cop tells me to mind my own business. Can you imagine this? I mean, this is what we have in the land of Israel now. This is a guy sitting on a bus. People are going to be sitting on that. And he's putting his mucus from his nasty nose on people's seats on a bus. I mean, what type of behavior is this? So this is the type of barbaric behavior that I saw when I was in Israel. And again, those two stories I've given you are nice stories, relatively speaking. I'm not going to tell you the really disgusting stuff, because there's even much more disgusting than that, which I'm not going to tell you because it's just too disgusting, and I don't want to go all the way out over the limit and tell people such horrible things. I saw things that are even worse than that. Horrible. We need to cleanse the land of Israel. We need to get rid of these people and convince them to leave with compensation. Convince them to leave, convince them to get out, so that we'll have a Jewish state that will be a light unto the nations and that will be a beautiful place to live. It'll be Israel without millions of Arabs would be paradise, would be absolute Garden of Eden, would be paradise. Thank you, Nekama. And now we go to the great Yamash Moda Lewinsky, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, who was more evil, Martin Lucifer Queen, Yamash Mova Zichro, or his namesake, Martin Lucifer, Yamash Mova Zichro? Okay, first let me translate. The Yamash Moda Lewinsky is referring to Martin Lucifer Queen, is actually referring to Martin Luther King. And Martin Lucifer, he's referring to Martin Luther. Both of them were evil people. Both of them were complete, very, very evil people. Martin Luther probably did a lot more damage historically. He called for burning synagogues. Martin Luther, by the way, was the founder of Protestantism and the Lutheran Church. And he was not like the evangelical Christians of today, not at all. He was a vicious, Jew-killing, Jew-hating beast in Germany. He was actually started out as a priest in the Catholic Church, and then he disagreed with some of the Catholic doctrines, so he wound up forming his own religious belief. That's what led to the Lutheran Church. And in 1543. He wrote a book called On the Jews and Their Lies, where he called for burning synagogues and massacring the Jews. And it led to many pogroms and massacres and expulsions of Jews, and eventually was one of the things that was used to justify the Holocaust. The Lutheran bishops in Nazi Germany supported Hitler enthusiastically, and it was one of the things that was used to justify the Holocaust. So he played a major role in the slaughter of huge numbers of Jews in Europe. Martin Luther King was also an evil person. He was a communist. He was a Jew hater. He was an ally of Malcolm X and other Jew haters that he met with and worked with. And he brought upon the United States a so-called civil rights movement, where he gave civil rights to certain people and took the civil rights away from everybody else. You know, it was like Rabbi Kahan always used to say, when we gave them civil rights, we lost our own civil rights. And that's basically what happened. Because there's certain people, you know, that you just... there's certain people that if you give them civil rights, it's just insane. It just destroys all of society. You can never, never make a civil right out of a moral wrong. And what Martin Luther King represented was a moral wrong. He represented affirmative action. He represented racial discrimination against whites in general and Jews in particular. He represented extortionist demands of the government to help blacks who in most cases were too lazy or too criminal to do what they by themselves should have been able to do and had plenty of opportunity to do but didn't do it because for their own reasons, because of laziness, because of bad lifestyle, you know, drugs, alcohol, illegitimacy, all the filth and degeneracy that is the dominant culture of the ghetto. They blame this on whitey, but it isn't the fault of white people, and all of society is paying the price for this. And in the end, all of America is being destroyed by it. And that's one of the things Martin Luther King certainly played a huge role in contributing to that. Thank you, Yamach Shmoda Lewinsky. Okay, one moment. Wow, this is going to be a long show here. I can see that already. Okay. I didn't realize how long this is going on. Okay. Now, the great Chicago Jew writes, and I quote, "What is the difference between Haredi, Hasidic, and Orthodox Judaism, and what are you?" Unquote. Well, first of all, Hasidism, let's start off with Hasidism. Hasidut is a movement that was started by the Baal Shem Tov in the 1740s. And it's a movement that, with a heavy emphasis on prayer, with kavanah, that means prayer with intention. In other words, you have to really intend what you're praying and really feel it. So it's prayer with intention, spiritualism, even dancing to show how happy you are, different clothing. And each Hasidic movement has a Rebbe. A Rebbe is like the master leader with special prophetic powers. And the Rebbes that to be prophets and to have special powers, special prophetic power. This was not what we had before the 1740s in traditional Judaism. It's not what we had. But it became a powerful movement, and eventually many Jews in Europe embraced the movement. That's the Hasidic movement. The Haredim include both Hasidim and non-Hasidim. The non-Hasidim, they call themselves Mitnagdim. They deny that they've adopted Hasidic views, but in reality they also have the same Hasidic views. They're the type of people who vote for Shas and Torah Judaism and these other parties. They claim that they're not really Hasidic, but they also have their Rebbes, like Harav Ovadia Yosef and others. They have their Rebbes, the same basic, they have that same attitude toward them, that they basically make them into prophetic figures. So that's the Haredim and the Hasidim. Now, traditional Torah Judaism. I don't use the term Orthodox because Orthodox is like a galut term. I mean, we can refer to them as Orthodox, but traditional Torah Judaism is simply following the Torah commandments. And it's believing in Eretz Yisrael. It's believing in an independent Jewish state. That's traditional Torah Judaism. Following the Torah commandments, believing that we have an obligation to live in Eretz Yisrael, believing that we have an obligation to support the state of Israel. That is the traditional Judaism, and that's the Judaism that I follow and that I believe in. So I would define my Judaism as traditional Torah Judaism. And by the way, I love the Hasidic Jews and I love the Haredi Jews. They're wonderful people. They're our brothers. If they do not believe in the sanctity of the land of Israel and the importance of living in the land of Israel and settling the land of Israel and not surrendering any land, and we're commanded to live there. If they don't believe in those things, then I very strongly disagree with them, and I think it's unfortunate if they don't believe in those things, and many of them don't. And that's unfortunate, because I think that we have to believe in Eretz Yisrael, and that we have to believe in settling and the land and understanding that our return to the land of Israel was an incredible, monumental miracle, and the greatest, and it's in fact the greatest miracle in modern Jewish history. I hope that answers the question to some degree, Chicago Jew. I thank you. And now we go to our great friend Da Vinci, who writes, and I quote, "George Bush Sr. and his wife were both recently witnesses at a same-sex wedding," quote-unquote, "between two women. Please comment on this," unquote. Yeah, well, you know, the Bushes have always been sickening people, sickening sellouts. Laura Bush always said that she's in favor of same-sex marriages, you know, so-called gay marriage. The Bushes, I mean, this is what these people are about. They're not real. They're certainly not real conservatives. They never have been. George Bush and his wife Barbara, George Bush Sr. and his wife Barbara, have always been left-wing sellouts. You know, the biggest charity that they gave to was Planned Parenthood, which is the biggest abortion provider in America. Planned Parenthood was created by a supporter of the Nazis. Actually, the founders of Planned Parenthood eventually became admirers of Hitler and the Nazis. And they believe in mass abortions. And they're the biggest abortion providers in America. George Bush Sr. and his wife, their biggest charity contribution was to Planned Parenthood, on their personal charity, the personal charity that they give. I mean, they're disgusting. They're nauseating, disgusting people. Now they attend weddings. Now they attend gay weddings. Doesn't surprise me. None of this surprises me at all. And that's why, you know, Jeb Bush, if he ever decides to run for president, he would be a disaster. A disaster. His brother, George W. Bush, was a disaster. His father was a disaster. I mean, they were terrible presidents. They were terrible. They're the ones that brought Obama into the White House. They did a terrible job. George Bush Sr. gave us Clinton because of his disastrous failures, and because of George W.'s disastrous failures, we wound up getting Obama. Thank you, Da Vinci. And now we go to the great Maimonides, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, is there a chance that the U.S. will attack Iran for the sake of Saudi Arabia, unquote. I don't think so. I don't think that's going to happen. I hope so, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think Obama is determined, and John Kerry, the vile, evil Secretary of State, I think they're determined to not only help Iran, but even to eventually remove the sanctions. They never wanted the sanctions, even. Obama has always tried to water down the sanctions. So a military attack, I certainly don't think that they have that they intend to do that. I don't think so. I think our hope for a military strike on Iran has to come from Israel. And unfortunately, I don't see Netanyahu is such a gutless worm. I don't think he's going to do it. But that's our one hope, is that Israel will feel so threatened that Israel will finally do it, God willing. We've got to try everything. We've got to do everything we can to try to convince the Israelis to do that. Thank you, Maimonides. And now we go to the great Dan Ben-Noach. Baruch Hashav. That means welcome back. I'm not translating it for Dan, because Dan Ben-Noach speaks Hebrew fluently. But I'm translating it for our other great JTFers. Dan Ben-Noach now writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, in the Arab world, if you beat a tuchus, you open a mind. But how can we open the minds of self-hating Jews, unquote? Very, very difficult. Very, very difficult, because all their lives they've been brainwashed. Or they are just bad, many of them are just bad people who just want to believe the evil things that they believe. So it's very hard. It's very, very hard to change the minds of self-hating Jews. We present people with the truth, and hopefully we'll get them to do tshuva. Do tshuva means that they do regret and repent for the wrong that they've done. And let's hope that we can influence them and get some of them at least to change their ways. But many of them are lost. Many of them are lost, and many of them are not going to be brought back. So it's not an easy task. We just present the truth, and we try to convince as best as we can, and hope that we can save as many people as we can save. Thank you, Dan Ben-Noach. And now we go to the great Binyamin Yisrael, who writes, and I quote, why is the Rav's name spelled with an E at the end, Kahana, Kahane, when it is pronounced with an A, Kahana, unquote. I don't know. Who knows? You know that the name comes from Kohanim. It comes from Kohanim. And in Hebrew, it's spelled with an aleph at the end. So it's definitely kahana. But it comes from the term kohanim, the name. And so why in English do... It's a distortion. I mean, you can say it's a distortion of the name, but that's the way they spell it. I don't know why. And it's not Rabbi Kahana's family only. It's everybody with that name spells it that way that I know of in America. In America, people with that name all spell it that way. So I don't know what the reason is. It's one of the things that gets distorted and when you try to translate things into foreign languages. Binyamin now writes, and I quote, "Also, please discuss the mayor of Newark, New Jersey," unquote. Oh, Mayor Cory Booker of Newark, New Jersey, who is probably going to be the next senator from the state of New Jersey. What a phony. He's a big celebrity. He loves to go on the TV shows and loves to be a big celebrity. And he's a weird person. He's a genuinely weird person. You know that 3 o'clock in the morning, he goes out for pedicures and manicures. He goes out to get his nails on his fingers and toes done at 3 o'clock in the morning. He's been known to go out and ask and have people do pedicures and manicures on him. So of course there are rumors about his sexual orientation and all of the types of rumors that have come up. He's a weird person. He's a weird person. I hope he's not going to be the next Obama. He's almost certainly going to be the next senator from the state of New Jersey. There's a special election being held, and he almost certainly is going to win. I hope he's not going to be the next Obama. Thank you, Binyamin Yisrael. And now we go to Australian Christian, who is new to the forum. Welcome to our forum. Welcome to JTF. Australian Christian writes, and I quote, "One, do you remember the details of the murder of Yonkel Rosenbaum by a black mob in 1991 in New York?" Unquote. Yeah, of course. Of course I remember. It was something we were very involved with because we started the group Jews Against Dinkins. David Dinkins was the mayor at the time. And what happened was there was a car accident in which a black kid was accidentally killed in a car accident. And Al Sharpton and all the black leaders came to Crown Heights. The driver of the car which the black kid was killed by, the driver of the car was a Lubavitcher Hasidic Jew. And so Al Sharpton and all the other black Jew-hating, white-hating demagogues came and started attacking the Jews. They started saying the Jews are all diamond dealers and they're exploiting the black community and so on and so forth. And Al Sharpton incited pogroms. For 4 days, blacks were rioting and there were black pogroms in Crown Heights against the Jewish community there. You have to understand, there were about 20,000 Jews in Crown Heights, about 20,000 mostly Hasidic Jews in Crown Heights, surrounded by about 600,000 or 700,000 blacks. Because you have Crown Heights, Bedford-Stuyvesant, you have a number of almost all black neighborhoods. At that time, they were almost all black. Now, there are some Hispanics that have moved in. But at that time, they were almost 100% black. You have almost all black neighborhoods like Bedford-Stuyvesant, Crown Heights, and other neighborhoods surrounding this Jewish community. And the Jews, you may wonder, why would the Jews live there when they're surrounded, you know, outnumbered 20 or 30 to 1 by these vicious Jew haters and criminals? Why would they want to live there? Good question. I wish they didn't live there. I wish they all moved to Israel. You know, I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy to live outside of Israel. But anyway, you know, and they're good Jews. And I love the Lubavitcher Hasidim, but I'd like to see them in Israel. I don't want to see them in Crown Heights. In any event, Yonkel Rosenbaum was an Australian Jewish yeshiva student who didn't even know anything about this. He had no idea. He was just walking down the street and this black mob of 20 black Nazis started screaming, "Kill the Jews, get the Jew." And they stabbed him to death. They murdered him and stabbed him to death and got away with it. One of them was eventually arrested and put in prison for just, like, I think he served 4 years in prison. I mean, it was just unbelievable, an unbelievable example of the type of miscarriage of justice. He was tried on second-degree murder charges, but a black jury found him not guilty. Even though he had the murder weapon in his hand, he was found with the murder weapon in his hand. He had the blood all over him. He confessed to two different police detectives. I mean, you couldn't have a more open and shut case. I mean, there was proof not beyond a reasonable doubt. There was proof beyond any doubt that he was guilty. And the black jury found him not guilty. And then after they found him not guilty, they went out and invited him to a turkey dinner. They invited him to dinner. Imagine this is the jury that's supposed to be impartial. They invited him to dinner and took him out to dinner because they wanted to pat him on the back for murdering this Jew. That was the jury. That's the so-called jury in Brooklyn. Why would Jews want to live in a place like that? In a place where you have such evil Nazi hatred sanctioned by the jury system, by the courts. Why would people want to live in a place like that? I don't know. But anyway, that's what happened. Yonkel Rosenbaum was murdered. There were 4 days of pogroms against the Jewish community in Crown Heights. Thank you for your question. And now we go to... another new member of our forum. And again, welcome. We welcomed you last week, but welcome once again. Hayamin Tzadak, who writes, and I quote, "Shalom Chaim, do animals have souls? Will the same plants and animals of this world be in the world to come? Is there justice, judgment for them?" Unquote. According to Harambam, animals do not have souls. So when an animal passes away or when a plant passes away, that's it. They simply pass away. They die a natural death. And they have no souls. Harambam is Maimonides, by the way. Now, are there other views among other rabbinic sages? There may be. I don't know. There may be other views. I just don't know. It's possible. There is talk about how animals will eventually rise to the level of human beings, and human beings will rise to the level of priests, or kohanim, and so. I mean, there is discussion of that. There is discussion of that eventually happening. But how that works, I have no idea how that works. A soul doesn't just mean the instinct of an animal. Animals have instincts. They live by instinct. But they can't go against their instinct, so they don't have free will. Human beings have free will. Human beings can go against their instinct. An animal can't. An animal does not go against their instinct. So that's why animals don't have souls. Because a soul, by definition, means somebody has free will and has the power to make decisions independently on their own. And that's something animals really don't have, because animals must abide by their instincts. Anyway, thank you, Hayamin Tzadak. And now we go to the great Ephraim Ben Noach, who writes, and I quote, "Shalom Chaim. Could you talk about last week's Torah portion in Haftarah? Thank you." Okay. Well, this is, you know, we just had Rosh Hashanah, which is the Jewish New Year. So the Torah portion is the very first Torah portion. We start again with Parashat Bereshit, which is the beginning. In other words, the very beginning of Genesis. 5,774 years ago, the world was finally ready to have people who would accept God's laws and rules, starting with Adam and Eve. That's what the story of Adam and Eve really is all about. Most of Chazal, by the way, most of the rabbinic sages tell us that Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden and the snake and the whole story, this is symbolic. This is a very, very important symbolism. They are very important. Every word, every letter has a meaning. But it is not to be taken on face value. It is a symbolic story. Also, most of Chazal do not believe that the world is literally 5,774 years old. What we do believe, and again, there are some who believe it, the Hasidim do believe that, so it depends who you're speaking about, but the majority view among Chazal is that what happened, the reason why it's spoken about the world being created and starting 5,774 years ago is because for the first time there were human beings who were capable of accepting God's laws and rules. In other words, who were moral enough. Because you have to have derech eretz. Derech eretz means a set of morals. A set of morals and civilized behavior. That has to, derech eretz kadma la Torah. It has to be before the Torah. You have to have people who are capable of accepting Torah with a certain, they have to have a certain modicum of morality, a certain minimum sense of morals in order to be able to accept the Torah. And you didn't really have that before 5,774 years ago. The world was so barbaric and so cruel, you didn't really have that. We first see in the time of Adam and Eve the beginning of people being capable to accept God's laws and God's rules and to be able to become prophets. Some of the people became prophets. I'm talking about pre-Torah prophets, prophecy among these are Gentile prophets, of course. And, you know, we see that happening. We see that happening because the world was ready for this and finally had reached the point where it could absorb and accept some of God's laws and rules. Most people didn't, you know, for most of history. But some people, at least a certain percentage of people in every generation, starting 5,774 years ago, a certain percentage did finally start being exposed to God's laws and truth and justice and so on. Now, why was the world created? The world was created so that God could share good with lesser beings. God wants to give us eternal life and happiness, but we have to earn it. He wants us to do this through our own free will. And so that the world would have Torah, which is the light of God. That's the goal. And someday it will occur. Someday the righteous are going to have eternal life and the wicked are going to face their judgment. All of this is going to happen someday. But it happens through free will and through tests. Now, here's the story from Bereshit, from our parasha this week. Adam, is commanded to eat from all of the trees in the Garden of Eden. Now, it says in Perek Bet, which is chapter 2 of Genesis of Bereshit, Perek Bet, it says Tet Zion, which is verse 16, it says, Vayetzav Hashem Elokim al ha'adam lemor, mikol etz hagan achol tochel. What does that mean? God says, God commands, the Lord God commands Adam, telling him, from every tree in the garden you are to eat. You're to eat from every tree in the garden. And then he goes on to say, but from the tree of knowledge you shouldn't eat. But first he says you should eat from every tree in the garden. So there's a contradiction there. First he's saying you should eat from every tree in the garden. Then he's saying, but from this tree you shouldn't eat, in the very next verse. So how do we, you know, what's the seeming contradiction there? Why is there a seeming contradiction there? First you're telling him you can eat from every tree, then you say, but this tree you shouldn't eat from. There's a reason for that. God was commanding Adam not to eat from the tree of knowledge before eating from the tree of life. He should have eaten from the tree of life first. Why? Because the tree of life, what is life? Life is compared to the Torah. The Torah is Torat Chaim, the Torah of life. Once he has the Torah knowledge necessary before confronting good and evil, because the tree of knowledge is the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Once he has the Torah knowledge necessary, once he has the spiritual strength necessary to deal with good and evil, then he can eat from all the trees in the garden, including the tree of knowledge. But to eat from the tree of knowledge and to basically say, I want knowledge now before, in other words, I want to learn all the subjects. I want to learn science and all and math and philosophy and history and all these subjects without having Torah knowledge, without having godly knowledge. If you do that, then you're going to learn in a distorted way. And you're going to learn in a bad way. That's the symbolic message here. So it wasn't that they ate from the tree. It wasn't that they ate from the tree of knowledge that was forbidden. They were actually commanded to eat from all of the trees in the garden. But first, they should not have eaten from the tree of knowledge before eating from the tree of life. If they had eaten from the tree of life first, if they had had the necessary knowledge to be able to deal with good and evil, to be able to study philosophy and history and science and everything else, if they had had the foundation, the spiritual foundation and basis necessary to first know the truth, then they could have also eaten from the tree of knowledge. But because they didn't, and because they ran straight to the tree of knowledge without eating from the tree of life first, that was their downfall, and that led to the fact that we have death in the world and that we don't have eternal life. So all of the world, all of history, is to return us to the point where we will know that we have to first eat from the tree of life, that we have to first have Torah knowledge before we confront the challenges of the world. That's that. All of history is to return us to that point and to overturn the sin and overturn the defiance of God's commandment here. I know that this is a little bit of a deep explanation, but that is a traditional Jewish explanation of Bereshit. And of course, the day will come when we will have knowledge again, and when we will have the Torah knowledge that we need in order to confront good and evil. That day will come. It says that the day. It says in that day that, in other words, when the Messiah comes and when we have final redemption, that the knowledge of God will fill the earth as the waters fill the seas. That is going to happen. That day is going to happen. But we are striving to reach that day. Once we reach that day, then the final redemption will come. That's Bereshit for this week. That's our parasha for this week. That's at least one of the aspects, one of the angles, one of the important aspects of this week's parasha. As far as the Haftarah is from the prophet Yeshayahu, Koamar, and that's a Haftarah which teaches us that when the Jews become a light unto the nations, Or Lagoyim, then we will witness a new beginning in the world, because the Haftarah this week speaks about the beginning, the new beginning and creation. Why does it speak about that? Because it's a Haftarah that's aligned with the book of Genesis that opens up with the book of creation. So the Haftarah from the prophets is something that is relevant to the story of Genesis in this case this week. And so we're taught that when the Jews become Or Lagoyim, when they become a light unto the nations, then we're going to see a whole new beginning in the world. There's going to be a whole new beginning, and a whole new world is going to open up for us in this world. There'll be a whole new world opening up for us in this world, a wonderful new world. That's what the prophet Isaiah, Yeshayahu, is promising us. That's the Haftarah for this week. Thank you, Ephraim. And now we go to I am a dog trapped in a human body undergoing transplant, who writes, and I quote, Dawood Cameron says the Nairobi and Pakistani attack had nothing to do with religion. Mentally ill, a sellout, or just stupid? What's the verdict? Unquote. Oh, he's just a sellout. He knows that these were Muslim terrorists. He knows what happened in Kenya, what happened in Pakistan, where they massacred huge numbers of people in a church who had just come out of a church service and just slaughtered them. He knows damn well that this was Islam. So this is just, he's just a sellout. He's just a liar and a sellout. Thank you. I am a dog trapped in a human body undergoing transplant, and I want to thank everybody. This was a very long show this week. Wow, more than an hour and a half this week. I want to thank everybody. Until next week, Shalom.